there. So even the most hardened cynic would admit that there were probably at least a billion hours of worthwhile viewing, and millions that would pass the highest standards of excellence. How to find these few, well, few million needles in so gigantic a haystack? The thought was so overwhelming, indeed so demoralizing, that after a week of increasingly aimless channel surfing, Poole asked for the set to be removed. Perhaps, fortunately, he had less and less time to himself during his waking hours, which were steadily growing longer as his strength came back. There was no risk of boredom, thanks to the continual parade not only of serious researchers, but also inquisitive and presumably influential citizens who had managed to filter past the palace guard established by Matron and Professor Anderson. Nevertheless, he was glad when, one day, the television set reappeared. He was beginning to suffer from withdrawal symptoms, and this time he resolved to be more selective in his viewing. The venerable antique was accompanied by Indra Wallace, smiling broadly. "We've found something you must see, Frank. We think it will help you to adjust. Anyway, we're sure you'll enjoy it." Poole had always found that remark a recipe for guaranteed boredom and prepared for the worst. But the opening had him instantly hooked, taking him back to his old life as few other things could have done. At once he recognized one of the most famous voices of his age, and remembered that he had seen this very program before. Could it have been at its first transmission? No, he was only 5 then. Must have been a repeat.
"Atlanta, 2000, December 31st. This is CNN International, 5 minutes from the dawn of the new millennium with all its unknown perils and promise. But before we try to explore the future, let's look back 1,000 years and ask ourselves, could any persons living in AD 1000 even remotely imagine our world or understand it if they were magically transported across the centuries? Almost the whole of the technology we take for granted was invented near the very end of our millennium. The steam engine, electricity, telephones, radio, television, cinema, aviation, electronics. And during a single lifetime, nuclear energy and space travel. What would the greatest minds of the past have made of these? How long could an Archimedes or a Leonardo have retained his sanity if suddenly dumped into our world? It's tempting to think that we would do better if we were transported 1,000 years hence. Certainly the fundamental scientific discoveries have already been made. Though there will be major improvements in technology, will there be any devices, anything as magical and incomprehensible to us as a pocket calculator or a video camera would have been to Isaac Newton? Perhaps our age is indeed sundered from all those that have gone before. Telecommunications, the ability to record images and sounds once irrevocably lost, the conquest of the air and space. All these have created a civilization beyond the wildest fantasies of the past. And equally important, Copernicus, Newton, Darwin, and Einstein have so changed our mode of thinking and our outlook on the universe that we might seem almost a new species to the most brilliant of our predecessors. And will our successors, 1,000 years from now, look back on us with the same pity with which we regard our ignorant, superstitious, disease-ridden, short-lived ancestors? We believe that we know the answers to questions that they could not even ask. But what surprises does the third millennium hold for us? Well, here it comes. A great bell began to toll the strokes of midnight. The last vibration throbbed into silence. And that's the way it was. Goodbye, wonderful and terrible 20th century. Then the picture broke into a myriad fragments,
And a new commentator took over, speaking with the accent which Poole could now easily understand, and which immediately brought him up to the present.
Now, in the minutes of the year 3001, we can answer that question from the past. Certainly, the people of 2001, who you were just watching, would not feel as utterly overwhelmed in our age as someone from 1001 would have felt in theirs. Many of our technological achievements they would have anticipated. Indeed, they would have expected satellite cities and colonies on the moon and planets. They might even have been disappointed because we are not yet immortal and have sent probes only to the nearest stars.
Abruptly, Indra switched off the recording.
We'll see the rest later, Frank. You're getting tired, but I hope it will help you to adjust.
Thank you, Indra. I'll have to sleep on it, but it certainly proved one point.
What's that?
I should be grateful I'm not a 1001-er dropped into 2001. That would be too much of a quantum jump. I don't believe anyone could adjust to it. At least I know about electricity, and won't die of fright if a picture starts talking at me.
I hope, Poole told himself, that confidence is justified. Someone once said that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Will I meet magic in this new world and be able to handle it?
Chapter 6. Brain Cap.
I'm afraid you'll have to make an agonizing decision, said Professor Anderson with a smile that neutralized the exaggerated gravity of his words.
I can take it, Doctor. Just give it to me straight.
Before you can be fitted with your brain cap, you have to be completely bald. So here's your choice. At the rate your hair grows, you'd have to be shaved at least once a month. Or you could have a permanent.
How's that done?
Laser scalp treatment kills the follicles at the root.
Is it reversible?
Yes, but that's messy and painful and takes weeks. Then I'll see how I like being hairless before committing myself. I can't forget what happened to Samson.
Who?
Character in a famous old book. His girlfriend cut off his hair while he was sleeping. When he woke up, all his strength had gone.
Now I remember.
Pretty obvious medical symbolism.
Still, I wouldn't mind losing my beard. I'd be happy to stop shaving once and for all.
I'll make the arrangements. And what kind of wig would you like?
Poole laughed.
I'm not particularly vain. I think it would be a nuisance and probably won't bother. Something else I can decide later.
That everyone in this era was artificially bald was a surprising fact that Poole had been quite slow to discover. His first revelation had come when both his nurses removed their luxuriant tresses without the slightest sign of embarrassment, just before several equally bald specialists arrived to give him a series of microbiological checks. He had never been surrounded by so many hairless people, and his initial guess was that this was the latest step in the medical profession's endless war against germs. Like many of his guesses, it was completely wrong. And when he discovered the true reason, he amused himself by seeing how often he would have been sure, had he not known in advance, that his visitor's hair was not their own. The answer was, seldom with men, never with women. This was obviously the great age of the wig maker. Professor Anderson wasted no time. That afternoon, the nurses smeared some evil-smelling cream over Poole's head, and when he looked into the mirror an hour later, he did not recognize himself. Well, he thought, perhaps a wig would be a good idea after all. The brain cap fitting took somewhat longer. First, a mold had to be made, which required him to sit motionless for a few minutes until the plaster set. He fully expected to be told that his head was the wrong shape when his nurses, giggling most unprofessionally, had a hard time extricating him.
Ouch! That hurt, he complained.
Next came the skull cap itself, a metal helmet that fitted snugly almost down to the ears and triggered a nostalgic thought, wish my Jewish friends could see me now. After a few minutes, it was so comfortable that he was unaware of its presence. Now he was ready for the installation, a process which he realized with something akin to awe had been the rite of passage for almost all the human race for more than half a millennium.
"There's no need to close your eyes," said the technician, who had been introduced by the pretentious title of Brain Engineer, almost always shortened to Brain Man in popular usage. "When setup begins, all your inputs will be taken over. Even if your eyes are open, you won't see anything."
"I wonder if everyone feels as nervous as this," Poole asked himself. "Is this the last moment I'll be in control of my own mind? Still, I've learned to trust the technology of this age. Up to now, it hasn't let me down. Of course, as the old saying goes, there's always a first time."
As he had been promised, he had felt nothing except a gentle tickling as the myriad of nanowires wormed their way through his scalp. All his senses were still perfectly normal. When he scanned his familiar room, everything was exactly where it should be. The Brain Man, wearing his own skullcap, wired, like Poole's, to a piece of equipment that could easily have been mistaken for a 20th-century laptop computer, gave him a reassuring smile.
"Ready?" he asked.
There were times when the old clichés were the best ones.
"Ready as I'll ever be," Poole answered.
Slowly the light faded, or seemed to. A great silence descended, and even the gentle gravity of the tower relinquished its hold upon him. He was an embryo, floating in a featureless void, though not in complete darkness. He had known such a barely visible, near ultraviolet tenebrosity on the very edge of night only once in his life, when he had descended further than was altogether wise, down the face of a sheer cliff at the outer edge of the Great Barrier Reef. Looking down into hundreds of meters of crystalline emptiness, he had felt such a sense of disorientation that he experienced a brief moment of panic and had almost triggered his buoyancy unit before regaining control. Needless to say, he had never mentioned the incident to the space agency physicians. From a great distance, a voice spoke out of the immense void that now seemed to surround him, but it did not reach him through his ears. It sounded softly in the echoing labyrinths of his brain. "Calibration starting. From time to time you will be asked questions. You can answer mentally, but it may help to vocalize. Do you understand?"
"Yes," Poole replied, wondering if his lips were indeed moving. There was no way that he could tell.
Something was appearing in the void. A grid of thin lines, like a huge sheet of graph paper. It extended up and down, right and left, to the limits of his vision. He tried to move his head, but the image refused to change. Numbers started to flicker across the grid, too fast for him to read, but presumably some circuit was recording them. Poole could not help smiling. Did his cheeks move? At the familiarity of it all. This was just like the computer-driven eye examination that any oculist of his age would give a client. The grid vanished, to be replaced by smooth sheets of color filling his entire field of view. In a few seconds, they flashed from one end of the spectrum to the other. "Could have told you that," Poole muttered silently. "My color vision's perfect. Next for hearing, I suppose." He was quite correct. A faint drumming sound accelerated until it became the lowest of audible C's, then raced up the musical scale until it disappeared beyond the range of human hearing into bat and dolphin territory. That was the last of the simple, straightforward tests. He was briefly assailed by scents and flavors, most of them pleasant, but some quite the reverse. Then he became, or so it seemed, a puppet on an invisible string.
He presumed that his neuromuscular control was being tested, and he hoped that there were no external manifestations. If there were, he would probably look like someone in the terminal stages of St. Vitus's dance. And for one moment he even had a violent erection, but was unable to give it a reality check before he fell into a dreamless sleep. Or did he only dream that he slept? He had no idea how much time had elapsed before he awoke. The helmet had already gone, together with the brain man and his equipment.
"Everything went fine," beamed Matron. "It will take a few hours to check that there are no anomalies. If your reading's K.O., I mean okay, you'll have your brain cap tomorrow."
Poole appreciated the efforts of his entourage to learn archaic English, but he could not help wishing that Matron had not made that unfortunate slip of the tongue. When the time came for the final fitting, Poole felt almost like a boy again, about to unwrap some wonderful new toy under the Christmas tree.
"You won't have to go through all that setting up again," the brain man assured him. "Download will start immediately. I'll give you a 5-minute demo. Just relax and enjoy."
Gentle, soothing music washed over him. Though it was something very familiar from his own time, he could not identify it. There was a mist before his eyes, which parted as he walked towards it. Yes, he was walking. The illusion was utterly convincing. He could feel the impact of his feet on the ground, and now that the music had stopped, he could hear a gentle wind blowing through the great trees that appeared to surround him. He recognized them as Californian redwoods, and hoped that they still existed in reality somewhere on Earth. He was moving at a brisk pace, too fast for comfort, as if time was slightly accelerated so he could cover as much ground as possible. Yet he was not conscious of any effort. He felt he was a guest in someone else's body. The sensation was enhanced by the fact that he had no control over his movements. When he attempted to stop or to change direction, nothing happened. He was going along for the ride. It did not matter. He was enjoying the novel experience, and could appreciate how addictive it could become. The dream machines that many scientists of his own century had anticipated, often with alarm, were now part of everyday life. Poole wondered how mankind had managed to survive. He had been told that much of it had not. Millions had been brain-burned, and had dropped out of life. Of course, he would be immune to such temptations. He would use this marvelous tool to learn more about the world of the fourth millennium and to acquire in minutes new skills that would otherwise take years to master. Well, he might, just occasionally, use the brain cap purely for fun. He had come to the edge of the forest and was looking out across a wide river. Without hesitation, he walked into it and felt no alarm as the water rose over his head. It did seem a little strange that he could continue breathing naturally, but he thought it much more remarkable that he could see perfectly in a medium where the unaided human eye could not focus. He could count every scale on the magnificent trout that went swimming past, apparently oblivious to this strange intruder. Then, a mermaid. Well, he had always wanted to meet one, but he had assumed that they were marine creatures. Perhaps they occasionally came upstream, like salmon, to have their babies. She was gone before he could question her, to confirm or deny this revolutionary theory. The river ended in a translucent wall. He stepped through it onto the face of a desert beneath a blazing sun. Its heat burned him uncomfortably, yet he was able to look directly into its noonday fury. He could even see, with unnatural clarity, an archipelago of sunspots near one limb. And this was surely impossible. There was the tenuous glory of the corona, quite invisible except during total eclipse, reaching out like a swan's wings on either side of the sun. Everything faded to black. The haunting music returned, and with it the blissful coolness of his familiar room. He opened his eyes. Had they ever been closed? And found an expectant audience waiting for his reaction.
"Wonderful," he breathed almost reverently. "Some of it seemed, well, realer than real."
Then his engineer's curiosity, never far from the surface, started nagging him.
"Even that short demo must have contained an enormous amount of information. How's it stored?"
"In these tablets. The same your audio-visual system uses, but with much greater capacity." The brain man handed Poole a small square, apparently made of glass, silvered on one surface. It was almost the same size as the computer diskettes of his youth, but twice the thickness. As Poole tilted it back and forth, trying to see into its transparent interior, there were occasional rainbow-hued flashes, but that was all. He was holding, he realized, the end product of more than 1,000 years of electro-optical technology, as well as other technologies unborn in his era. And it was not surprising that, superficially, it resembled closely the devices he had known. There was a convenient shape and size for most of the common objects of everyday life, knives and forks, books, hand tools, furniture, and removable memories for computers.
"What's its capacity?" he asked.
"In my time, you were up to a terabyte in something this size. I'm sure you've done a lot better."
"Not as much as you might imagine. There's a limit, of course, set by the structure of matter. By the way, what was a terabyte? I'm afraid I've forgotten."
"Shame on you! Kilo, mega, giga, tera. That's 10^12 bytes. Then the petabyte, 10^15. That's as far as I ever got."
"That's about where we start. It's enough to record everything any person can experience during one lifetime."
It was an astonishing thought, yet it should not have been so surprising. The kilogram of jelly inside the human skull was not much larger than the tablet Poole was holding in his hand, and it could not possibly be as efficient a storage device. It had so many other duties to deal with.
"And that's not all," the brain man continued. "With some data compression, it could store not only the memories, but the actual person."
"And reproduce them again?"
"Of course. Straightforward job of nano-assembly."
"So I'd heard," Poole told himself, "but I never really believed it." Back in his century, it seemed wonderful enough that the entire life work of a great artist could be stored on a single small disk, and now something no larger could hold the artist as well.
Chapter 7. Debriefing.
"I'm delighted," said Poole, "to know that the Smithsonian still exists after all these centuries."
"You probably wouldn't recognize it," said the visitor who had introduced himself as Dr. Alastair Kim, Director of Astronautics. "Especially as it's now scattered over the solar system. The main off-Earth collections are on Mars and the Moon, and many of the exhibits that legally belong to us are still heading for the stars. Someday we'll catch up with them and bring them home. We're particularly anxious to get our hands on Pioneer 10, the first man-made object to escape from the solar system.
I believe I was on the verge of doing that when they located me."
"Lucky for you. And for us. You may be able to throw light on many things we don't know."
"Frankly, I doubt it, but I'll do my best. I don't remember a thing after that runaway space pod charged me. Though I still find it hard to believe. I've been told that Hal was responsible."
"That's true. But it's a complicated story. Everything we've been able to learn is in this recording. About 20 hours. But you can probably fast most of it. You know, of course, that Dave Bowman went out in the No. 2 pod to rescue you, but was then locked outside the ship because Hal refused to open the pod bay doors. Why, for God's sake?
Dr. Kim winced slightly. It was not the first time Poole had noticed such a reaction.
"Must watch my language," he thought. "God seems to be a dirty word in this culture. Must ask Indra about it."
There was a major programming error in Hal's instructions. He'd been given control of aspects of the mission you and Bowman didn't know about. It's all in the recording. Anyway, he also cut off the life support systems to the three hibernauts, the Alpha crew, and Bowman had to jettison their bodies as well.
So, Dave and I were the Beta crew. Something else I didn't know.
What happened to them? Poole asked. Couldn't they have been rescued? Just as I was?
I'm afraid not. We've looked into it, of course. Bowman ejected them several hours after he'd taken back control from Hal, so their orbits were slightly different from yours. Just enough for them to burn up in Jupiter, while you skimmed by and got a gravity boost that would have taken you to the Orion Nebula in a few thousand more years. Doing everything on manual override, really a fantastic performance, Bowman managed to get Discovery into orbit round Jupiter. And there he encountered what the second expedition called Big Brother, an apparent twin of the Tycho monolith, but hundreds of times larger. And that's where we lost him. He left Discovery in the remaining space pod and made a rendezvous with Big Brother. For almost 1,000 years, we've been haunted by his last message. By Deus, it's full of stars.
Here we go again, Poole told himself. No way Dave could have said that. Must have been, my God, it's full of stars.
Apparently the pod was drawn into the monolith by some kind of inertial field because it, and presumably Bowman, survived an acceleration which should have crushed them instantly. And that was the last information anyone had for almost 10 years until the joint U.S.-Russian Leonov mission,
which made a rendezvous with the abandoned Discovery so that Dr. Chandra could go aboard and reactivate Hal. Yes, I know that.
Dr. Kim looked slightly embarrassed. Sorry. I wasn't sure how much you'd been told already. Anyway, that's when even stranger things started to happen. Apparently, the arrival of Leonov triggered something inside Big Brother. If we did not have these recordings, no one would have believed what happened. Let me show you. Here's Dr. Heywood Floyd keeping the midnight watch aboard Discovery after power had been restored. Of course, you'll recognize everything.
Indeed I do. And how strange to see the long-dead Heywood Floyd sitting in my old seat with Hal's unblinking red eye surveying everything in sight. And even stranger to think that Hal and I have both shared the same experience of resurrection from the dead.
A message was coming up on one of the monitors, and Floyd answered lazily.
Okay, Hal, who's calling?
No identification. Floyd looked slightly annoyed.
Very well, please give me the message.
It is dangerous to remain here. You must leave within 15 days.
That is absolutely impossible. Our launch window does not open until 26 days from now. We do not have sufficient propellant for an earlier departure.
I am aware of these facts. Nevertheless, you must leave within 15 days.
I cannot take this warning seriously unless I know its origin. Who is speaking to me?
I was David Bowman. It is important that you believe me. Look behind you.
Heywood Floyd slowly turned in his swivel chair away from the banked panels and switches of the computer display towards the Velcro-covered catwalk behind.
Watch this carefully, said Dr. Kim. As if I needed telling, thought Poole.
The zero-gravity environment of Discovery's observation deck was much dustier than he remembered it. He guessed that the air filtration plant had not yet been brought online. The parallel rays of the distant yet still brilliant sun, streaming through the great windows, lit up a myriad of dancing motes in a classic display of Brownian movement. And now something strange was happening to these particles of dust. Some force seemed to be marshaling them, herding them away from a central point, yet bringing others towards it until they all met on the surface of a hollow sphere. That sphere, about a meter across, hovered in the air for a moment like a gigantic soap bubble, then it elongated into an ellipsoid whose surface began to pucker, to form folds and indentations. Poole was not really surprised when it started to assume the shape of a man. He had seen such figures blown out of glass in museums and science exhibitions, but this dusty phantom did not even approximate anatomical accuracy. It was like a crude clay figurine, or one of the primitive works of art found in the recesses of Stone Age caves. Only the head was fashioned with care, and the face, beyond all shadow of doubt, was that of Commander Dave Bowman. "Hello, Dr. Floyd. Now do you believe me?" The lips of the figure never moved. Poole realized that the voice, yes, certainly Bowman's voice, was actually coming from the speaker grill. "This is very difficult for me, and I have little time. I have been allowed to give this warning. You have only 15 days. "Why, and what are you?" But the ghostly figure was already fading, its grainy envelope beginning to dissolve back into the constituent particles of dust. "Goodbye, Dr. Floyd. We can have no further contact. But there may be one more message if all goes well." As the image dissolved, Poole could not help smiling at that old space-age cliché, "if all goes well." How many times he had heard that phrase intoned before a mission. The phantom vanished. Only the motes of dancing dust were left, resuming their random patterns in the air. With an effort of will, Poole came back to the present.
"Well, Commander, what do you think of that?" asked Kim.
Poole was still shaken, and it was several seconds before he could reply. The face and the voice were Bowman's, I'd swear to that. But what was it?
"That's what we're still arguing about. Call it a hologram, a projection. Of course, there are plenty of ways it could be faked if anyone wanted to, but not in those circumstances. And then, of course, there's what happened next."
"Lucifer?"
"Yes. Thanks to that warning, the Leonov had just sufficient time to get away before Jupiter detonated. So whatever it was, the Bowman thing was friendly and trying to help, presumably. And it may have been responsible for that one more message we did receive. It was sent only minutes before the detonation. Another warning."
Dr. Kim brought the screen to life once more. It showed plain text. "All these worlds are yours except Europa. Attempt no landings there." The same message was repeated about 100 times, then the letters became garbled.
"And we never have tried to land there?" asked Poole. "Only once, by accident, 36 years later, when the USSS Galaxy was hijacked and forced down there and her sister ship Universe had to go to the rescue. It's all here, with what little our robot monitors have told us about the Europans."
"I'm anxious to see them."
"They're amphibious and come in all shapes and sizes. As soon as Lucifer started melting the ice that covered their whole world, they began to emerge from the sea. Since then, they've developed at a speed that seems biologically impossible. From what I remember about Europa, weren't there lots of cracks in the ice? Perhaps they'd already started crawling through and having a look round." "That's a widely accepted theory. But there's another, much more speculative one. The monolith may have been involved in ways we don't yet understand.
What triggered that line of thought was the discovery of TMA-0, right here on Earth, almost 500 years after your time. I suppose you've been told about that?
Only vaguely. There's been so much to catch up with.
I did think the name was ridiculous, since it wasn't a magnetic anomaly, and it was in Africa, not Tycho.
You're quite right, of course, but we're stuck with the name, and the more we learn about the monoliths, the more the puzzle deepens, especially as they're still the only real evidence for advanced technology beyond the Earth.
That surprised me. I should have thought that by this time we'd have picked up radio signals from somewhere. The astronomers started searching when I was a boy.
Well, there is one hint, and it's so terrifying that we don't like to talk about it. Have you heard of Nova Scorpio?
I don't believe so.
Stars go nova all the time, of course, and this wasn't a particularly impressive one. But before it blew up, N-Scorp was known to have several planets.
Inhabited?
Absolutely no way of telling. Radio searches had picked up nothing, and here's the nightmare. Luckily, the automatic Nova Patrol caught the event at the very beginning, and it didn't start at the star. One of the planets detonated first, and then triggered its sun.
My God! Sorry. Go on.
You see the point. It's impossible for a planet to go nova, except in one way.
I once read a sick joke in a science fiction novel. Supernovae are industrial accidents.
It wasn't a supernova. But that may be no joke. The most widely accepted theory is that someone else had been tapping vacuum energy and had lost control.
Or it could have been a war,
just as bad. We'll probably never know. But as our own civilization depends on the same energy source, you can understand why N-Scorp sometimes gives us nightmares.
And we only had melting nuclear reactors to worry about.
Not any longer, thank Deus. But I really wanted to tell you more about TMA-0's discovery, because it marked a turning point in human history. Finding TMA-1 on the moon was a big enough shock. But 500 years later, there was a worse one, and it was much nearer home, in every sense of the word, down there in Africa.
Chapter 8. Return to Olduvai. The Leakeys, Dr. Stephen Del Marco often told himself, would never have recognized this place, even though it's barely a dozen kilometers from where Lewis and Mary, 5 centuries ago, dug up the bones of our first ancestors. Global warming and the little ice age, truncated by miracles of heroic technology, had transformed the landscape and completely altered its biota. Oaks and pine trees were still fighting it out to see which would survive the changes in climatic fortune. And it was hard to believe that by this year, 2513, there was anything left in Olduvai undug by enthusiastic anthropologists. However, recent flash floods, which were not supposed to happen anymore, had re-sculpted this area and cut away several meters of topsoil. Del Marco had taken advantage of the opportunity, and there at the limit of the deep scan was something he could not quite believe. It had taken more than a year of slow and careful excavation to reach that ghostly image, and to learn that the reality was stranger than anything he had dared to imagine. Robot digging machines had swiftly removed the first few meters, then the traditional slave crews of graduate students had taken over. They had been helped, or hindered, by a team of 4 Kongs, who Del Marco considered more trouble than they were worth,
However, the students adored the genetically enhanced gorillas, whom they treated like retarded but much-loved children. It was rumored that the relationships were not always completely platonic. For the last few meters, however, everything was the work of human hands, usually wielding toothbrushes, soft-bristled at that, and now it was finished. Howard Carter, seeing the first glint of gold in Tutankhamun's tomb, had never uncovered such a treasure as this. From this moment onwards, Del Marco knew, human beliefs and philosophies would be irrevocably changed. The monolith appeared to be the exact twin of that discovered on the moon 5 centuries earlier. Even the excavation surrounding it was almost identical in size. And, like TMA-1, it was totally non-reflective, absorbing with equal indifference the fierce glare of the African sun and the pale gleam of Lucifer. As he led his colleagues, the directors of the world's half-dozen most famous museums, 3 eminent anthropologists, the heads of 2 media empires, down into the pit, Del Marco wondered if such a distinguished group of men and women had ever been so silent for so long. But that was the effect that this ebon rectangle had on all visitors, as they realized the implications of the thousands of artifacts that surrounded it. For here was an archaeologist's treasure trove. Crudely fashioned flint tools, countless bones, some animal, some human, and almost all arranged in careful patterns. For centuries, no, millennia, these pitiful gifts had been brought here by creatures with only the first glimmer of intelligence as tribute to a marvel beyond their understanding. And beyond ours, Del Marco had often thought, yet of 2 things he was certain, though he doubted if proof would ever be possible. This was where, in time and space, the human species had really begun. And this monolith was the very first of all its multitudinous gods. Chapter 9. Skyland. "There were mice in my bedroom last night," Poole complained, only half seriously. "Is there any chance you could find me a cat?" Dr. Wallace looked puzzled, then started to laugh. "You must have heard one of the cleaning microts. I'll get the programming checked so they don't disturb you. Try not to step on one if you catch it at work. If you do, it will call for help, and all its friends will come to pick up the pieces." "So much to learn, so little time." No, that wasn't true, Poole reminded himself. He might well have a century ahead of him, thanks to the medical science of this age. The thought was already beginning to fill him with apprehension rather than pleasure. At least he was now able to follow most conversations easily, and had learned to pronounce words so that Indra was not the only person who could understand him. He was very glad that English was now the world language, though French, Russian, and Mandarin still flourished. "I've another problem, Indra, and I guess you're the only person who can help. When I say God, why do people look embarrassed?" Indra did not look at all embarrassed. In fact, she laughed. "That's a very complicated story. I wish my old friend Dr. Khan was here to explain it to you, but he's on Ganymede, curing any remaining true believers he can find there. When all the old religions were discredited, let me tell you about Pope Pius XX sometime, one of the greatest men in history. We still needed a word for the prime cause, or the creator of the universe, if there is one. There were lots of suggestions. Deo, Theo, Jove, Brahma. They were all tried, and some of them are still around, especially Einstein's favorite, the old one. But Deus seems to be the fashion nowadays. I'll try to remember, but it still seems silly to me." "You'll get used to it. I'll teach you some other reasonably polite expletives to use when you want to express your feelings. You said that all the old religions have been discredited. So what do people believe nowadays?" "As little as possible. We're all either deists or theists." "You've lost me. Definitions, please."
They were slightly different in your time, but here are the latest versions. Theists believe there's not more than one God. Deists, that there is not less than one God.
I'm afraid the distinction's too subtle for me.
Not for everyone. You'd be amazed at the bitter controversies it's aroused. 5 centuries ago, someone used what's known as surreal mathematics to prove there's an infinite number of grades between theists and deists. Of course, like most dabblers with infinity, he went insane. By the way, the best-known deists were Americans. Washington, Franklin, Jefferson?
A little before my time, though you'd be surprised how many people don't realize it.
Now I've some good news, Joe. Professor Anderson has finally given his... What was the phrase? Okay. You're fit enough to go for a little trip upstairs. To the lunar level.
Wonderful! How far is that?
Oh, about 12,000 kilometers.
12,000? That will take hours.
Indra looked surprised at his remark, then she smiled.
Not as long as you think. No, we don't have a Star Trek transporter yet, though I believe they're still working on it. But you'll need new clothes, and someone to show you how to wear them, and to help you with the hundreds of little everyday jobs that can waste so much time. So we've taken the liberty of arranging a human personal assistant for you.
Come in, Daniel.
Daniel was a small, light brown man in his mid-30s, who surprised Poole by not giving him the usual palm-to-palms